Thank you, Erica. Hi, everybody. I'm glad you could all make it. I was sitting in the airport the other day on the way to working with one of our partners, and this whole Grinch thing, as I was watching, you know, the Christmas season, the Grinch came up, and the Grinch is so angry about noise, noise, noise. And it occurred to me that it was the same problem that I was heading out to address in the field. And so I thought it'd be interesting to talk about, you know, what is the noise? What is the noise pain? Why are we unhappy with noise? Why do we have noise? And really, how can we deal with noise? And the thing that we want to do is we want to take the noise that's coming in, and we don't want to pull a Grinch and go in and wipe out the entire town. What we want to do is take much better measures that are going to be effective in reducing noise without having to, you know, go nuclear. So in order to control noise, it's very important to first understand what is it that people call noise. And there's quite a few different definitions. Imagine a lot of people think of noise as an incorrect message, right, which is a lot more complex than it sounds on its first hand. But the idea that the message just, it comes through and it tells me, for example, I have a misspelled word and the word is spelled properly. It tells me a test failed, but the test succeeded. So the message is just completely wrong. And that's noise, and it requires a special kind of addressing because essentially you need to fix it. Unhelpful messages. So, you know, if I have a person monitoring the system for failures, getting ready to release it, and it tells him I have, you know, 10,000 things passed and two failed, he may only be focused on the failed. Now, if it's a simple 2 out of 10,000 failed, that's probably helpful. If, on the other hand, it shows him line by line, 10,000 lines of this test passed, this test passed, this test passed, this test passed, then it's a lot of noise because there's really nothing he needs to do about that. So the message itself isn't very helpful. Unhelpful messages also fall in the area of just didn't get you where you need to go. So, for example, when you're on the computer and you get a blue screen of death, or you get something on a web page that says system is busy, it's not helpful, right? So that's another form of helpful. Irrelevant messages that are just there. You don't necessarily need them, don't want them, not germane to the thing that you're doing right now. So any message that doesn't actually, in my mind, give me something actionable to do or give me a data point that I can then choose my next action on. So again, if I have a test suite and I have a policy that says 90% pass rate is okay for release, then I need to know that. If I get a whole bunch of low-level detail, again, it's not really relevant to me. And really, my definition of noise, which is broader than a lot of developers would like to hear on our side, at least, people who are building tools, is anything I don't need to hear is noise. If it's not something that, again, I can do something immediately about, that I really don't want to hear it, I want to find a way to make it go away. Anything, as I put here kind of twice, right, anything I don't need to hear, anything I don't want to hear, right? And they both kind of fall in the same category for me. So let's ask ourselves then, given these kinds of buckets that noise can fall into, why is testing noisy? And one is just poor tools, right? If you have a tool and it just makes a whole bunch of noise, then you really probably should just look at ditching it. And, you know, a classic example here, not to beat up on a tool, but everyone's heard of Lint, and no one uses Lint. And Lint, could be argued, created the whole modern static analysis category, and still no one uses it. And the reason is that it just tells you too many things that you don't care about, and there's no way to really make it shut up. And so think of this like a spell checker that won't let you add words to the dictionary. It's an inappropriate tool and you shouldn't use it. So look at your tool. If the tool's producing a lot of noise and it doesn't have any mechanism where you can either tune its configuration or trim its noise down, then look for a different tool. Poor configuration, and we'll discuss that a little more in a minute, but basically if you tell tools to do more than they should, then they'll generally produce noise. Or if, for example, you turn on debugging messages because you were debugging a problem and you left them on, then it ends up being very, very noisy. So make sure that the tool is really set up for optimal output. poor strategy. And again, we'll discuss that in detail in just a moment. But, you know, if you're not doing the right thing, not testing the right thing, not using the right tests, then you end up with something that's very noisy. Or if you're not running your tests at the right frequencies. And so we'll look at that in more depth in a minute. And poor design. Again, some tests, some tools, some testing methods. In static analysis, there are certain rules that I try to avoid that sometimes people like because they sound theoretically interesting. But when you look at the rule, you look at it and you say, wow, this is so likely to throw false positives or throw messages that are contextually sensitive and the context is going to be unclear and I won't be able to deal with it. So those kinds of things I really try to avoid. Again, I'd rather have a small number of clear-cut answers that I can actually deal with than this massive amount of noise that just makes me crazy. And poor policy. And again, policy comes down to, you know, how do we manage noise and what do we have people do? So it might be something as simple as you need to clean your test suite so they're not producing extraneous noise. You need to use suppressions and static analysis so that we don't ship until we have 100% compliance rather than 50% from the tool and 50% spot check. That your policy says, you know, human spot checking needs to be minimized, that, for example, unit tests need to be run frequently so that they're kept up to date. So these kinds of things in the policy really help you define what goes on. And I know it seems kind of crazy because when you're at the moment of dealing with the noisy regression test suite, you feel like policy is the last thing that will help you at this moment. But in some cases, a policy might be, hey, let's reset everything to zero and start new today, and that helps you establish a new baseline to deal with noise. So policy can be very, very important. So test design, let's drill into that a little more deeply. You need to plan out what you're going to test, what you want to test, how it's going to be tested. And this is an area that sometimes people kind of skip. It's great to tie it into your requirements so you know, hey, we need to show that the software does X, Y, Z. Now, I find that people who are in a compliance marketplace, such as FDA or PCI or MISRA, tend to be pretty good about this, and they tend to plan their tests out because they have to show an audit trail to someone that shows that they tested something and that the test passed. For everyone else, or for all the other features that don't show up in there, it's still good to plan out, hey, I need to test this, and to test it, I need to show a screen capture, or I need to capture an email that goes in and out of the system, or things like that. So plan what your artifact is, think about the artifact that's a result of the test, and make sure the artifact ideally, A, you know, proves that the thing is right, B, doesn't have a false positive, for example, a classic case, a web page with a date on it. And if the web page is, you know, a credit card form, and there's a copyright date for the website at the bottom of the page, the copyright date changes, and all of your regression tests fail, well, that's ridiculous, right? So that kind of planning that you really want to put in place. Code review, and here's one that a lot of people really skip, and I think that at this point in time, code review, or peer code review, really, is something that is almost universally agreed is a very useful thing in software development. And we tend to apply it when we're writing code, and we tend to ignore it when we're creating tests. And I assert that we should also be reviewing the tests. So when I create my test plan and say, okay, I'm going to do screen captures for these things, I'm going to write unit tests for these things, I'm going to do record and playback for these things, I'm going to do manual tests for these things, that we review the plan with a bunch of people and make sure that it proves what we want. And then when you get down to creating your individual tests, especially more complex tests, that again you go for a review phase where someone will look at it and say, does that really do what you think it does? Does it really have the right output? Does it really prove that the thing works so that our FDA compliance will be met? So particular questions like that that you want to ask during a peer test review rather than just strictly a code review. Again, as I just mentioned, the base thing in creating a test is, does the test prove my point? Now, I was working with a customer a few years ago that had a VPN tool that would work through a web page. So it's not Log Me In or anything like that, but something like that where you could go to a web page, You could put in your credentials and you could log into your desktop machine wherever it happened to be. And they wanted to check the VPN software itself. And the checks for the VPN software involved starting up Outlook on a remote machine and checking that you could read an email, send an email, copy an email, move an email, archive an email, create an email, etc. And they were having troubles with these tests being noisy. And I asked, well, what does this test prove? Once you've connected to the system, I said, if I'm looking at a VPN, I need to test that I can't get in with an insecure connection, I can't get in with bad credentials, that the login's successful with proper credentials, that the packets going back and forth are being encrypted, and that my desktop shows up, and a few things like that. Does this test prove any of those? Well, some of them, but not explicitly. If this test fails, if I can't, you know, if I click the compose new mail in Outlook, what does it mean? I don't know. So that's really the question. Does the test prove what's gone wrong? Does it prove what's gone right? And without that, it's not really a useful test. You might have a whole bunch of tests and you feel like the sum is useful, but if you look at each individual test, you should be able to prove to an auditor that, yep, see, this thing worked. This test did this, this came out, that means it worked. And when it fails, that it gives you some meaning rather than, well, I couldn't send email in Outlook. What does that mean for my VPN? I don't know. Does it mean my credentials failed? I have no idea. So I need much more granular tests. Integration tests are important. They need to be tied to these granular lower level tests so that I can understand what the problem is. And again, if I write my test this way where they're actually, I look at it and I say, well, gosh, I've got these 10 different email tests in Outlook to prove my VPN. It turns out one test would do the job just the same. As long as I brought Outlook up and it worked, I'd be happy. And that would give me something much less noisy, much easier to maintain, quicker to write, quicker to run, et cetera, et cetera. So test configuration. Here's a real simple one. I would think this should be a no-brainer. Don't test code you won't change. I run into this over and over and over again. People running tests on a particular piece of code. I had a person I was dealing with. We were running static analysis. We found in a C file, we found a piece of code where the scope was ambiguous. So in other words, we had two variables with the same name, and it was obvious to the compiler that at any given time you couldn't be sure which variable you were going to get. So this sort of ambiguous scope is not easy to create. When you hit it, you have to ask yourself, oh my gosh, what's going on in my code? And so the particular developer said, well, I'm not going to change this. It's like, well, suppress it. Well, I don't want to suppress it. It's like, well, if the message is real and you believe it's real and you believe it's important, you're not going to change it. Why are you testing this code? Well, this code is legacy code and we're not allowed to change it unless we have a field report. Okay, then don't test it, right? There's no sense testing something you're not going to change. Doesn't really matter. The classic one, again, running tests you plan to fix someday. So people turn on tests, they turn on static analysis rules that sound like a good idea. We don't have the time right now, but we just want to, the classic phrase people use is create a baseline, right? And a baseline of things you don't fix isn't a useful baseline. A useful baseline is where am I today? What am I going to fix? How am I going to fix it? These kinds of behaviors create incredible amounts of noise. I've seen people who had 5,000 static analysis violations from a single rule, which tells me that this rule doesn't fit their development practice very well, and telling me, well, someday we're going to comply with that. And my answer is, well, then turn it on someday, but don't turn it on today. Someday is never going to come. So that's the basic parts of configuration. Make sure you're testing the right thing. Make sure you're running the right tests. Because if you're running a test that isn't important or is rarely important, then run it on that rare occasion. If you're testing code that isn't being changed and isn't allowed by policy to be changed, then again, don't run new tests against this code. Only run your legacy tests to make sure it didn't accidentally get changed. And make those legacy tests produce no noise because you're not going to fix any of the assertions. So whatever it takes, make them noiseless. So let's look at ways to tone things down. And the number one sort of simple way, assuming that you basically got the right configuration, that you're running the right tests, is now to apply suppressions. So sometimes I need to apply suppressions when I'm doing unit testing or when I'm doing static analysis especially. Unit testing I worry a little about because unit testing suppressions generally come down to at some point there's an assertion made, and the assertion says, you know, the return variable from this method shall produce 4, and the input is 2 plus 2, therefore 2 plus 2 equals 4. And if 2 plus 2 isn't equaling 4, I can suppress this, but probably I have a bad assertion. But it is possible to have assertions that you might need someday, so you just need to apply a suppression. But think about that. Static analysis, again, another case, I need to be able to apply suppressions to make sure that this particular rule that's very important in file A but isn't important in file B is firing the way I need it to fire because it's really contextual sort of a rule. So I need to be able to do suppressions, and again, this comes back to my tool selection and my configuration. I need to be able to suppress by file. I might have files that legitimately we don't touch because they're complicated, they're dangerous, they haven't been touched in a while, etc. So I need to suppress by file. I need to be able to suppress by type. This static analysis thing I never want to see. This kind of unit test assertion I never want to see, etc. So that is very helpful. By age, this is a great way to clean up your test suite very quickly. Don't bother looking at errors that come out of code that hasn't been changed in, say, 5 years. Maybe for you it could be 10, maybe for you it could be 1. Draw a line in the sand and suppress everything older than that line in the sand, knowing that you're not really going to touch that code anyway. And maybe on the flip side, when you touch that code, the age changes anyway, and now it starts to apply, and you can clean up everything. So these kinds of suppressions are all very useful ones. And another one is just by severity. So again, if I was just starting or I had a very noisy test suite, I would probably turn off everything but Sev1. And if it turned out Sev1s weren't making the noise, I'd turn on the Sev2s. If they weren't making noise, I'd look at Sev3s, and I'd probably just suppress them all. If we've been shipping and these noises have been there, then we should accept them as noise, suppress them so we don't look at them in the future. It's funny because a really simple way of creating a proper policy for how to deal with your improvements to your test suite is to look at where you're at today, set that as your goal. So, for example, if I have a test suite and I've got 80% code coverage and I've got 100 messages that come out of it, my rule is in the next version, no more than 100 messages, and ideally 90, and then 80, and then 70. Take a very incremental approach. And again, if you have tests that are failing, have failed constantly, and you know that you're okay with it, simply suppress them or turn them off, knowing that their change isn't going to change your behavior. Test maintenance. And again, this is just one of the classic things that can really get you into trouble. One is you need to run your test suites on a regular basis. There's a basic law of physics that entropy increases, and this happens in your test suite at a furious pace. If you're not running your test suite, it's getting dirtier. I know that seems crazy, but the code is changing, and the test suite isn't, and therefore it's becoming dirt. So you need to make sure that you're running really, really regularly, and that you're keeping it clean regularly. So if I do it, for example, on check-in, that I run unit tests associated with the code being committed because it was just changed, and I clean noise, at that moment, my noise is going to be pretty limited. And it's going to be very easy for me to say, you know what, that assertion's wrong, that assertion's not helpful, that assertion is just on a piece of code we're never going to deal with, et cetera, and make those decisions very quickly. So you need to run on a regular basis, keep the thing clean. You can't just say, okay, well, we have a release every 90 days, so on day 89, we're going to start running test suites, and we're going to clean them up. It just won't work that well for you. Again, turn off low value-to-noise ratio tests. So in other words, if I look at a particular test and I say, well, this test has a 50% chance of actually having a helpful message when I go and dig into it, and the chance, even when it does occur, is something that I may or may not fix, I certainly wouldn't hold my release for, I'm probably going to turn that off. Right? So really think about, in some cases, you're going to find that the noise is worth it. If I have something that has a, let's say, a 30% chance of finding a nasty memory leak, and it takes me 2 minutes every time I run it to quickly investigate it, it might be worth it to me because the cost of finding the memory leak is so much higher than the cost of dealing with this noise. But you need to really look at that at that level. One of the simple ways I look at these ones with low value to noise ratios is I take a test suite and I run it, and then I run it twice in a row and see which results are different. And anything that got different with an exact same run on the same code is a noisy assertion or a noisy test and should be turned off. Another simple way to detect these noisy ones is to move it from one machine to another machine. And again, if you compare results across machines and you got a pass on one machine and a failure on another, you can look at it because it might be that it's a real problem, or it might be that it's a thing that's just dependent on some funny variable or some funny thing, nature of the OS, and therefore isn't telling you something useful. And another simple way to find these high noise, low value things is to run on a different date, because if you have date-related assertions, suddenly they're going to show up. So those are a couple of ways that you can deal with test maintenance. But understand, keeping the thing clean is much more effective, much simpler than a mass periodic cleaning where once a release or twice a year you sit down and go, let's clean the test suite. Because you know what's going to happen. You're not going to actually clean it to zero at that point. You're going to clean it to the point that you go, you know what, we got to release anyway. And then you're going to stop. And if you treat the tests that way, then you're really not looking for value in them and things are going to hide. Again, I hate to come back to a spell checker, but it's such a simple system that everyone has. But think about a spell checker doing software development things. And software development words are going to show up as misspelled words. And somewhere in the midst of an article that you write about software development, some of those funny particular words are going to be real spelling errors. If you haven't taken the time to train your particular spell checker what your words are, then you're probably going to miss some of those actual misspelled words in the sea of underlined redness. On the other hand, if you've got an article and you've written some, you know, 10,000 word article and it's due in 20 minutes, you really don't have the time to keep it clean. So keeping it clean as you bump into it is really just the best possible policy. Now, relevance, right? And this is, again, am I testing for things that are actually happening? In other words, not just this will exist in my code, but it exists in the real world. It's something that could happen to me. It's something that I actually care about. So I look at my QA results and say, are these things that are going to happen on the field? So let's say that I'm testing for out-of-memory condition, and I'm on a system that's got so much memory, and we never have leaks, and you know, things move on anyway, then it's not necessarily as critical to test. So you really have to ask yourself, are these things happening to me? I can use code review to help me look at my results and say, are these things happening? Again, talking about, you know, peer review of my tests and saying, is this something that matters? Is it something I care about? Is it something I will deal with? A simple rule of thumb that I like to use for initial choice around testing, and it's a very pragmatic approach. Ideally, we fix all things. But a very pragmatic approach is, if this thing occurs, would I stop a release for it? And if the answer is no, I really need to question whether or not I want to deal with its noise. Eventually, someday, I might. That doesn't mean I want to deal with it today. Field bugs is a great way to find out things that are happening. So if I look at problems that are occurring in the field and I have tests that are related to my bug tracking system, these are great things to do. If I have similarly things in my code reviews that are happening over and over that my developers, maybe my senior developers are finding my junior developers do, then that's a great thing to test for, right? If QA is finding things, then again, those are great things to test for because they're finding this bug. That's something you should be trying to find ahead of time. And again, as I said, things that are expected to happen. So security, right? If I have an internal-only system and it's a thick client do I really care that somewhere in the system I have a possibility of a SQL injection, right? If I happen to have maybe even everyone in the company has the password to the database and they can dump the thing if they want. So make sure it's, you know, security that you care about, security that's real. These days with cloud, security is a much bigger issue and might hit you everywhere. But also make sure that rather than testing for every possible weird security thing, that you're checking for the things that will really happen to you, like SQL injection and cross-site scripting. Performance. Do I have a performance SLA that I really need to make sure that my application runs in a certain time frame? If so, that's the kind of tests I need to make sure are working. That's expected to happen to me. Am I running in a cloud, and do I expect particular servers to drop out of existence? Then I need to check that. Do I expect resources to come and go and disappear? Then I need to check for that. So those are the kinds of things. So I view this as really a kind of a risk management process when I'm looking at the noise, because over and over again I've been telling you drop this test, drop that test. And as risk management, what I'm really saying is, will this thing that I'm looking at happen? And then I ask myself, what's the cost if it happens to me? What's the cost if I fix it? And if it turns out that the cost of testing it and dealing with the noise is cheaper than letting it happen in the field, then pragmatically maybe I just don't need to worry about that right now. So a classic example, if you look at security, there's a whole bunch of different security issues out there that you can be chasing. And some of them have low probability of occurring and some have high. OWASP Top 10 really looks at what are the top 10 things likely to happen to you. And so it gives you a really great place to start. So again, if you're looking at your tests and you find that a noisy test is looking at something obscure and requiring you to constantly validate the results against this obscure probability, then it's something that is really, from a risk management perspective, it's a reasonable risk to let it kind of slide. On the other hand, if it's something that might be obscure but causes a tremendously dangerous or expensive problem, then it's something you want to check for. So hopefully these kinds of things will really help you clean up your test suites and help you draft your own approach to making life less noisy. So with that, I'd like to find out, see if we have any questions that came through the system. It looks like someone kind of spelling error in my slide, thank you. Let's see. So I don't have any offhand. So let's see here. One just came through. So how much user flexibility does Parasoft static analysis tools provide? So okay, great leading question. We have suppressions based on all the kinds of things that I showed you. We also have source control integrations. So with source control being tightly coupled with static analysis, the nifty thing is that I can look at suppressions and say, hey, I don't want to touch code that was written 10 years ago, or I don't want to touch code that has not been updated. So I can tell the difference between original code date, I can tell the difference between code last touch date, I can be connected into the bug tracking system so that I could write a policy that says code that's, you know, over 5 years old doesn't get touched for static analysis unless there's an open problem report against it from the bug tracking system. So those kinds of integrations with other pieces of my development testing platform let me be extremely flexible. And we have a simple language that you can actually do it inline in the code itself, so that's very persistent. So you can turn off a rule, a class of rules. You can turn it off by method. You can turn it off at the line. You can turn it off at the file, at the class, etc. And those kinds of things are really very helpful. Customize existing analysis, and that's another great thing. I'm glad that I should have put that in myself. With static analysis, sometimes you're a parameter away from having the right amount of noise out of your tool. So if I look at something like, complexity metric, and your policy says, well, complexity metric above 30 is something that's got to be code reviewed. And if your static analysis tool flags it every time it's over 20, then you've got a pretty good chance that you're going to have a bunch of excess noise in your system. So looking for static analysis rules that are parameterizable is a very useful way to decrease noise. We have a lot of those, obviously. And creating more specific rules. So again, sometimes you look at a rule and say, well, that rule is close to what we want, but we also want to take into account some other issue in the code. So being able to create new rules, and again, we have a graphical wizard that you can use that lets you actually draw rules in a sort of a flow chart, and so it makes it very, very easy to produce new rules. So I believe that's all the questions we had. I thank everyone for the time, and Erica, I'll turn it back.